succession number 26868, reel 10.
What were some of those stories that stuck out that you can recall in relation to their actions?
Well, enough was of what they did to some of our pilots and so on. They just removed them. They weren't POWs.
Was that happening, as far as you were aware, throughout the war, or was it just towards the end?
Oh, it was happening a bit, I think, all the time. Not all the people, but with some. Just after what I just mentioned with the lost division, my number two was with me one moment, the next minute he was gone. I called him on the radio, got no reply, so I went back over the course we'd been. There was a fair amount of cloud cover, so there wasn't much space between the cloud and the mountains. I couldn't find him anywhere, no sign, so in the end I had to come back alone. Well, I was a bit upset about that because this chap had been a pupil before and he was a very, very good number two. But we heard the story later from a letter he wrote to us. He eventually finished up in the German POW camp where he, which way did it go? He dodged the Nazis for quite a while, and then they caught him. And the strange thing was the train that he was on. We suddenly strafed them, and he looked out and he saw the letters AK. He thought, "Cool, they can shoot." And he was out quickly and he got into a trench somewhere or some ditch and he was covered with Germans and so on. And in the melee after this, he managed to bolt. And he stayed at large for about 10 days, but unfortunately they caught up with him and took him back to the POW camp in Germany. And then we heard through the Red Cross that he was a POW. So I was relieved that he hadn't boarded, as it was said.
Given your job in strafing, obviously goods trains as well as military targets in that respect, how were you able to ensure that you weren't actually firing on, for instance, your own men in relation to them being transported from one position to another?
Well, with the trains, well, we reckoned our own people weren't very many there. With the trains, we never attacked anything but the engine or the flak car. The rest was pretty safe. Had another interesting trip. We're talking about the Gestapo lot. The Allies had a few people in Yugoslavia and other places with a long-range radio, and they were observers finding out what was going on and sending back information in code and so on. And we received word that this one chap's batteries were running out, and he was running out of other things as well, including food. So a drop was required. So I took off with two long-range tanks on instead of bombs. And in the long-range tanks was food, more wirelesses, batteries, all the things that he might need. And a map, very detailed map, of where he was supposed to be. And also that when we came over this area and flew around, he would let off some purple smoke just a bit and stop, so we could see just where he was. But we came to the area, the just two of us, circled around. The idea was to do it very quickly so we didn't draw attention to him, was the main thing. No smoke. So we went further out around because we didn't want to actually pinpoint that position to the Germans. And there was nothing came up, so that was more or less aborted. And on the way back, we were very, very close, within a few minutes of where this had happened, we came on a new camp being put up, and it was a Gestapo camp. And that was the reason he wasn't there. He'd found they were there and he'd bolted somewhere else. But we caught them completely and utterly unawares. And they had a whole lot of timber buildings that they were half... Some of them were erected and some were halfway. So we set into those with the armour-piercing incendiary and left most of the camp on fire when we left. Most of the people bolted, but we blew up the camp pretty much.
Were you able to, or were you aware of any of the other atrocities that were happening in relation to the Nazis and concentration camps, for instance?
No. In Albania, practically anybody who was shot down there, there was goodbye, even if they bailed out. They were very bad lot there. Tirana, I think, was the capital around that area.
Why was that the case, do you think? Why did it differ?
Well, the Albanians and the Ustashi were very, very pro-German. And so they reckon they were fighting their war effort against us. So we returned the favour.
You talk of obviously the Stasi. What about the people related to Tito?
We didn't see much of them. In fact, really, ever did we see them at all, because they had been told to hide, keep out of the way, and so that if anybody we did see were Germans. I saw them on one occasion, one chap flying in my lot, he got hit with anti-aircraft fire. His engine was knocked, so he bailed out the way I'd been telling you earlier of being shot out virtually by my trimming the aircraft forward. Saw his parachute open, so that was fine. Kept well away at almost maximum distance to be able to see the parachute. Saw him land. And then we saw figures rush in and pick him up and take him up the mountains. And as we were going up the mountains, we realised that they were partisans. And they kept him, looked after him. They nearly killed him with getting through icy rivers a couple of times. And they had to abort because they found the Germans where they didn't expect them. And he had terrible trouble while he was with them, with body lice. They had a drop from the Halifaxes of, I think it was 458 Squadron, of various food and guns and various things, whilst he was with them, and he concentrated on grabbing some DDT powder. He just put handfuls of powder inside his clothes to get away from this terrible itch of these body lice. So to answer your question, we rarely saw the partisans.
How are they seen, though, in relation to their position in the war?
As allies. Oh, very much so.
And Tito?
Ally. It was somewhere in the Yugoslav area that Randolph Churchill was in amongst them there. Also, one of my friends was in that area, the Honourable Willie Wiley. He'd been on a previous squadron together and we shared a tent. But to join the Air Force, he'd put his age back and he was having trouble seeing, so they took him off flying. So they put him on this job. And whilst I was based at Zara, one day I got a message over the radio, there's a friend of yours coming down from the mountains. Can you be around at such and such a time? And I did, and it was Willie Wiley. And he gave us some interesting information on how things were going behind.
What sorts of things did he tell you?
I can't remember a lot because he'd been up there without any grog for a while and so on, so it was a bit of an excuse for him to come and let down, and then he had to go back to the harsh life in the mountains again.
The Chetniks as well. What did you know of them?
Nothing. None at all.
There was, as I understand, this sort of what has been sort of named fluid situation as regard what was going on the ground in relation to the politics of the place. Competition between not only the Germans but the other factions.
Well, there was, because the Eustachi were pro-German and a lot of the Croats and Tito was largely Serbian. So what was coming out a few years ago was more or less brewing then, or had been brewing for ages.
You talked earlier on about use of tracers.
Yeah.
And that you didn't use tracers when you were flying.
Well, I gave the example of one chap flying through his target. Likewise, if you're busy watching the tracers, you're getting too involved with that. Very often your shooting went off and your assessment of this distance went off. So I reckon they were quite honestly dangerous. They served no useful purpose if you could shoot straight. And you knew that your guns and the sight, your gun sight were probably harmonized.
How would you harmonize the gun sight?
You've got an open area away from the runway somewhere. You had jacks to lift the tail of the aircraft until it was in the correct flying position at a normal speed. That's the sort of horizontal position. Then you sighted through the aircraft to a spot that you're harmonizing the guns, usually of about 400, 500 yards away, and put up your target there at the same level that the aircraft was aiming at. Then you made certain that the gun sight was on that as well. And then each of the guns, by an instrument looking through the barrels and so on, was onto that. Sometimes in fighter operations, some of the people had the guns which were spraying out a bit. But with the operations we were on, you had 36 seconds of firing generally. So you didn't want to waste ammunition. You didn't want stuff going out there. You wanted it where you were aiming. So we aimed it on a point. Again, fine, as long as you were shooting straight, or aiming straight.
Presumably also if you were at the right height on firing.
That didn't matter whether you were going that way to the target or that way at the target, it was still there because it was the attitude of that aircraft at a specific speed, which was the normal cruise speed. See, it was going very slow, the tail would be down. It was going extremely high, the tail would be marginally higher. Another of our targets there was Pola Harbour in the northern Adriatic. It was a fuel base. And also it had E-boats, I think they were called, which were motorboats stacked with explosives and a special cockpit set up at the rear. So if they were going to attack a Royal Navy corvette or cruiser or something like that, they set the E-boat, the actual skipper of the boat, set it directly for them, and when he was close enough that he reckoned he was there, he jettisoned his own little thing at the back, which was float, and away went the thing, rather like it was an AIM torpedo, in fact. The Royal Navy were very scared of these, and they kept clear of the Adriatic generally because of those E-boats. So Pola Harbour had most of these, and we very often were instructed to bomb the harbour where there was the fuel storage and the E-boats. Pola Harbour was known as Little Berlin. The extent of the ACAC was frightening. When you came in, the high-altitude ACAC, the 88mm, was bursting all around you, whatever you did. You had to dive through a sparse cloud of smoke of the exploding shells from the medium ACAC every time. Except some mornings. And there was one day where I came back. It was really a rough trip. We all got through it, but without any holes, but it wasn't very nice. And when I went to briefing that night, there was a wing commander in the wing who was one of these people nobody got on with. He was supercilious. He was cutting, he's a thoroughly nasty fellow. And he said something to me about how'd you get on. I said it was a pretty rough thing. He said, it's damn peculiar. Every time you're out, it's rough, and everybody else, nothing. And I hit the roof. I really told him what I thought of him. I said, right, you fly number four to me tomorrow. This was all in front of the group captain. Within seconds, the group captain was on and said, right, you're doing that. You're flying number four to Max. Well, the next day we went up. I almost felt sorry for him, bugger, because when I turned to dive, he was completely surrounded. I could barely see his plane for the smoke of the 88mm bursting. And then he had to go down through the other. He never commented again after that. But the group captain rather thought the same way as I did about this chap.
How do people like that affect the squadron? You mentioned earlier morale.
Morale when I went to that squadron was pretty hopeless and defensive and so on, and with a fairly, well, almost a complete changeover of pilots, it was the reverse. It was morale was high, aggressive, and I did find that the losses seemed to be greater with squadrons who were defensive, and if you were aggressive, you got away with more and came out intact, as well as also scoring very much more, in fact furthering the war effort. Another rather interesting thing was that the Mustang had the 0.5 guns on either wing. Incidentally, if when you got to the end of your ammunition, if one side finished first, suddenly your aircraft screwed round with the recoil was so much that it went round like that. You had to keep bringing it back if you only had guns firing on one side. So they had the big ammunition panels on the wing just beyond the centre where the greatest depth was in the wing. This day we were bombing beyond the mountains in Yugoslavia, and I had gone down on the target, I'd lifted the nose slightly, then pressed the button to release the bombs, went to start pulling up because at that stage we were travelling at nearing 600 miles an hour, nearly vertical, so ground was coming up fairly quickly. And suddenly, bang, I got a bang on the side of the head, which nearly knocked me unconscious, and the plane did a sort of half a roll, which I stopped, came back, was still going down, tried to pull it back to gain height, and it started the flick again. So I knew something was wrong. I couldn't see anything was wrong at this stage. And there was no way I could get it to lift the nose until I decided to do the thing which was more or less the position of the rudder and control to go into a spin, which meant the aircraft was skidding sideways, lifting the wing more on the side that was dropping than the other. And by doing that, the noise was unbelievable, even with the muffs on the ears and the microphones in there. That was just the scream of the aircraft going virtually semi-sideways. And gradually I got the nose up. It was still rather touch and go. And I remember hearing one of the pilots in the flight saying, "Look at the boss, he's shooting up the egg." I wasn't doing that, I was trying to save myself. Well, I finished up about 300 or 400 feet above the trees, still going some sideways. But when I'd got it so far, I thought, well, I'm going to make it. And as the speed dropped off, I found I was getting more control. And when I got it back to about 250 miles an hour, I had fairly reasonable control and was able to look round. And what had happened was the ammunition panel across the wing had blown up. It was held down by a lever which had buttons through a hole like that in a slot. And under the stress of the lift on the wing, it had pulled it up. So what I couldn't see it was that the front end edge of the thing was stuck in underneath and was holding, but the back edge was up about this. And what it was doing was completely negating the lift on that part of the wing. So the other wing was flying round it. So what it actually had was a, more or less a stall